Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 24 of NML Crossing, where we're celebrating 1 month of programs here. How about that? 1 month to the day, which sadly makes this one of my longest-running projects of the last little while. I'm not sure if that's something to feel good or bad about. It might just be one of those things that just is, huh? In any event, I am coming to you today from not only the squeaky chair, but from my sick room here. I am still dealing with whatever the hell this crud is. Kind of sucks that allergies and the flu have overlapping symptoms, so I don't know what the hell's going on here. So I guess apologies in advance if my voice and delivery are somehow worse than usual today. But, as usual, we will do the best that we can, or at least try to do the best we can. I'm recording this after a sweep of the house here. As you're listening to this, it's February 1st, and it's a little embarrassing to say that I still haven't finished taking care of all the Christmas crap at my house. We bought a bunch of, like, oversized ornaments, and don't have anywhere to put them, so they're kind of just sitting on an end table. So I've walked past this table every day, right? And it's weird how Christmas decorations can go from being like the coolest thing in the world to like the most sad thing in the world, just depending on when you're looking at them. So we've definitely reached that sad point in our house. So I gotta just remember to order a box on Amazon or wherever so I can pack these damn things up. Anybody else out there leave their Christmas stuff out for extended periods of time, or is it just me? I mean, it was a weird Christmas this year. It took us until, like, the day of to actually feel any sort of Christmas spirit, and then I guess we just didn't want to let it go or something. I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, enough of that. Enough of that. Let's get into today's book, which is the flagship. It's Batman 556. Which had a July 1998 cover date. The story title is odd. It's Help, Trapped, Money, Rescue, Ruins. Written by Doug Mensch with pencils by Norm Breakvogel. Inks Joe Rubenstein, letters Todd Klein, colors Gregory Wright and Android Images, edits Gore Finkel O'Neill, cover price $1.95. Now we open in the ruined dining hall of Wayne Manor, where Bruce and Tim are clearing out some wreckage and discussing their recent run-in with the Ratcatcher. Tim kind of nebbishly brings up that whole, hey, you mentioned something about me taking over sort of situation, but it's kind of nuanced into chatting up their commitment to the job, their undying commitment to doing what they can for the people of Gotham. Now, Bruce says something along the lines of being a little worried that perhaps he's asking far too much of Tim. Endangering himself, giving up too much of his youth, stuff like that. He wonders if perhaps Tim as Robin should stand in the light instead of in the dark. After the quake, so much has been left uncertain. He thinks that the very ground they stand on could disappear from under their feet. Tim, I mean, he's a little bit less jazzed about the conversation at this point. You know, it's a little more ambiguous as to what Bruce might have in mind or what Bruce's succession plan is here. I'm sure it hasn't changed. It's just Bruce's, stuff's percolating in his head here. Luckily for Tim, Dick and Alfred arrive to interrupt. Now, the discussion turns back to the problem of having the manor rebuilt without giving up, you know, the big secret. Alfred, being the only person here able to see the forest for the trees, suggests that, hey, maybe we just, like, empty the cave of all its Batmaniness, and we plead ignorance. Like, I mean, caves can be anywhere, right? Especially after an earth-shattering quake. And does anybody think that Batman operates out of a cave anyway? For all any repair crew might know, the great big gaping cave is just more quake damage. And well, that argument's good enough. It's decided that Alfie's plan might just be crazy enough to work. And so, now we've got a direction. Oof, and before we go on here, here's a quick investment tip. Put all of your money in nose spray. The way I'm going through this crap right now, you'd get a return on your investment very, very quickly. Anyway, Bruce suits up to head off on patrol, and he tells everyone else to, you know, be at the ready, just in case the people of Gotham need them too. We follow Batman to the First Federal Bank. where it's feared that a trio of folks have been locked in the vault for upwards of 72 hours. And of course, 72 hours was one of those like magic time frames used by search and rescue teams that we discussed in that New York Magazine article a few episodes back. Now, we get to see the trapeze, and it's three would-be robbers. Now, they got access to all the money they'd ever need, but, well, no way to actually use it. On top of all that, unless a miracle occurs, they're probably going to be dead soon. And just like that, Batman arrives. He refers to these geeks as Fast Frankie and Accomplices, which I think is the same name as one of the many, many, many Arizona law firms you'll see advertising on expressway billboards. Anyway, Double F and the gang attack and get their butts kicked in the three panels that follow. They immediately surrender and seem more than happy to be headed back to Blackgate. Oh, they were among the Blackgate escapees in the Isle of Men one-shot we discussed a few weeks ago. We jump to 2 hours later, and we join Bruce Wayne, who's holding court with some board members at Wayne Corp. And he's doing like the, you know, his normal aloof billionaire thing. He's practicing his putt. He's, you know, putting a golf ball into a little tipped over glass while asking and fielding questions. Now, among the folks present is our old pal Jojo Relazzo. She reports that all the quaking, moderate to major aftershocks and all, ought to be over with at this point. All of her testing indicates that everything is back to being relatively seismically stable. Bruce takes this to mean that it's now time for Gotham to actively and aggressively begin the rebuilding process. Jolene agrees and says it's already underway, mostly due to Bruce Wayne himself. He asks if there's been any pushback on the topic of earthquake proving all the new builds, and Jolene says there hasn't been. And I suppose that stands to reason, doesn't it? The insurance companies were especially keen on the earthquake proving, which also completely plays, doesn't it? Bruce turns to Lucius Fox for a report. Gotham apparently wants to honor Bruce and his contributions during these troubling times. Bruce is cool with it, so long as Fox can attend the ceremony in his place. Fox further reports that everything seems to be headed in the right direction. Seems to be less needy people, so they're getting like less requests. Everybody's getting pretty much what they need to survive. Wayne employees are being farmed out to other cities at their full salaries. Yeah, like he said, everything's headed the right way compared to where it's been, I suppose. You gotta leave it to the next guy to slap us with a hard dose of reality. It's a dude named Preston something or another, and he's Wayne's head bean counter. And he's here to remind everyone that, money, even Bruce Wayne's money, is in fact a finite resource. Bruce says spend, before excusing himself to go carousing. Next thing we know, Batman is swooping in on a strange situation. We've got officers surrounding the entrance of a would-be condemned building, and they're attempting to talk an old man into leaving the horribly unsafe structure. The old fella, he refuses. He says that this crap hole's been his home for 30 years, and it's really all he's got. Well, that's not all he's got. He's also got a rifle, and he doesn't seem afraid to use it. Just then, Batman seems to materialize right next to him. Our man tells the fogey that it's more dangerous inside than out. Just then, like magic, the ceiling crashes down, and the whole damn place begins to implode. Batman nabs the fella and dives out the window to safety just as the old brick dwelling comes apart. And of course, from our time with the New York Magazine article, we know what happens to those old brick dwellings in earthquake scenarios. Anyway, Batman, he's out of there before the dust literally settles. The police approach the old man, who's got happy tears in his eyes. He's happy to be alive, and he was happy to have just met a dark angel. Because, of course, Batman ain't real. Back at the manor, Tim and Alfred talk a bit about the cleanup, and Tim doesn't seem to realize that Bruce has been gone for, like, almost an entire day at this point. Alfred tells him he probably went to the bank. From here, we jump to a scene outside the bank where Gina Scoville of WGTV News is talking about the bank vault situation. And something tells me this page has got to be in the book out of order. I gotta figure this was probably supposed to be in between the bank and the Wayne Corp scenes. Otherwise, it makes very little sense, and it also makes Robin look completely out to lunch. Let's jump back to Bruce. He's walking the ruined streets with his main squeeze, Vesper Fairchild, on his arm. He asks her what callers to her radio show are saying, and she's initially a bit playfully irked that Bruce hasn't bothered listening himself, but makes with the details all the same. She explains that the current temperature of the city is complicated. She describes talk radio as an electronic soapbox used mostly for people to complain, even, maybe especially, when there's nothing to actually complain about. Now that there is actual worrying and complain-worthy stuff going on, the city has softened. People are coming together in shared empathy, all having lived through something almost unthinkable. And get back to the New York Magazine article, remember, we read about the phases of community there. She refers to it as the same boat syndrome. And I think the psychologist in the article referred to it as the honeymoon phase. You know, rescues are mostly done, and we haven't reached the questioning, cynical point yet. This is just like a happy to be alive, we're all in this together sort of a vibe. Now, Bruce walks Vesper home. Her building is damaged, but livable. Our man talks about seeing another building fall on his way to the radio station to pick her up. Vesper can tell by his tone that Bruce is very, very protective of the city. And, well, she has no idea, right? Now, Vesper assures him that this isn't the end for Gotham. It will be rebuilt, largely in thanks to Bruce himself. Time will heal all the wounds and soften any spiritual scars. They hug and part company as the sun begins to rise, and that's where we leave it. Next time out, we'll be looking at Shadow of the Bat, number 77. Now, an interesting piece in the letters page here. We don't actually have any letters to discuss here, but the letters we do see are discussing the last issue of Batman Before Cataclysm. So hopefully, starting with the next issue, we ought to be able to start including these missives and discussing the hot takes of the day. All right, so how about we talk about this one here? You know, like we saw in Robin 54 last episode, this issue very much feels like one of those, you know, quiet post-crossover issues or stories of yesteryear. We do get a little bit of action with, you know, we got the bank vault and the condemned building Michigas here, which was kind of a necessity back in the long ago. Now, the action, that is, not necessarily dealing with vaults or buildings, but it kind of feels a bit like an afterthought. The odd pagination with the bank vault story really adds to that as well. I mean, it's no big deal to me. I ain't mad at it. It only ate up a few pages, and at the end of the day, the book's called Batman, so probably be in our best interest to show him doing his thing, right? Now, my main takeaway for this issue is definitely the focus on Bruce Wayne and how he's dealing with the aftermath. And we get to see that depicted several different ways here. We see him as the patriarch of the Bat family. We get to see him as the head of Wayne Corp, and also as Vesper Fairchild's boyfriend. And Vesper Fairchild's such a hard word to say. a hard name to say. It's two words. Now, all three Waynes are different in their demeanors and presentation in the fallout of the Gotham tragedy. Bruce of the Batcave, he's still very mission-focused. He's basically Batman without the mask here, and that totally stands to reason. However, without the mask, there's like almost a paternal side to him on display. His conversation with Tim following up on their, you know, chat in the rocket tunnel was very nice to see. I liked seeing Bruce worried about Tim having to follow in his footsteps, you know, living in darkness instead of the light. It's a very human depiction here, perhaps now more than ever. The quake being this unthinkable sort of tragedy, I would imagine that put many, many, many things into perspective. Life being as short and as fragile as it is, the world being so unpredictable, and, I mean, nothing being guaranteed. I think this was a very strong bit of character work. It might not have gone as deep as it could have, but I appreciate that the topic was raised and now it's on the table. I'd imagine that this will probably come up again at least a few times. You know, not to jump back into Usenet, but one of the buzz phrases I've been seeing over there, like, over and over again, I believe it was first said by editor Jordan Gorfinkel, it's that the No Man's Land era was being referred to internally as Batman Year 10, also known as the Battle Batman Couldn't Win, where they strip, like, almost everything away from Batman in order to study him at his core. kind of sounds like a Batman flavored Born Again, I suppose. You know, that having been said, I totally get digging into his psyche a bit here. And I'm hopeful that there's more digging to be done. Bruce at Wayne Corp. He's back to wearing a mask. It's a, you know, not the bat mask, but he's doing that aloof billionaire thing. Almost to the point where it might appear to his staff that all of his good deeds and metric tons of cash going to Gotham's restoration are maybe accidental, is not the right word for it, but not intrinsic. Like, he's not thinking too hard about it. It's just that he's got the funds and assets, so why the hell not, you know? When the bean counter tries to remind him that cash is very much a finite resource, Bruce seemingly dismisses it, which kind of walked the line for me as being incredibly altruistic or incredibly out to lunch. Now, of course, we readers have a different perspective than the characters in the book. We know it's altruism. We know that he's going to do anything in his power and then some in order to protect and restore his city. But the other characters in the book might not be so sure. They might just see some disconnected businessman slash philanthropist who's totally out to lunch with financial reality, which I would guess is exactly how Bruce wants some of them to think of him. It's like a perfect deniability, I guess. Bruce sending Lucius Fox to claim his award or reclaim or whatever the hell it is from the city, that was a nice touch. And also, in my mind, walks that line. Like, we readers know that Bruce is far too busy and focused on his mission to take the time to get some empty applause. But to those in the book, they might just think he doesn't care, or would rather go play 18 holes, or have some beautiful woman to jet off somewhere with. Thought that was a really good scene. Very subtle and really, really good. On top of that, we get to see our pal Jojo Relazzo again. That was cool. I think I said last time we saw her that it was her penultimate appearance, but I was mistaken. This is apparently the second to last time we'll be seeing her, though I might just be wrong again. So stay tuned and we'll find out together. And finally, let's take a look at Bruce the boyfriend. Now, this is where he comes across, at least to me, is being the most genuine. It's where Bruce himself seems to have trouble walking that line. Now, I don't know much about the Vesper-Bruce relationship, outside of how it ends, that is, so I can't really speak to their closeness or whether or not anything had happened to inspire a great deal of trust between them. That said, I feel like this scene really worked in giving Bruce a soundboard. Like, he's not talking to the family, where every conversation is this odd blend of personal and professional. I think we've all been in those situations, like when you're cutting it up with your boss, or maybe you're the boss cutting it up with your employees, and you're having a good, you know, fun chat, but there's like that underlying sort of vibe where it could always go into work, business, pulling rank. Not even just to be a jerk about it, right? But just like something might come up and work will have to get done. So it's like you're never really 100% at ease talking with the boss here. It's never just going to be a friendly chat and nothing more. So we got Bruce here talking to Vesper, and he's not putting on airs. He doesn't have to act like he's semi-clueless. He actually gets to talk about what the city means to him, how protective he is of it and its people. It's the sort of stuff that we know about him, but doesn't, in my experience, get all that much lip service in his interpersonal relationships in the book. And I thought that was really, really cool. I thought it was a very nice touch. Overall, extremely minor quibbles about the tacked-on action scenes, I guess the mixed-up pagination aside, I thought this was a great character-focused little ditty. A much-needed check-in with the man behind the mask. Or rather, the man behind the masks. But I think that's all I got to say about the issue. I was going to hop into the mailbag here, but I'm sorry, I could barely see straight right now. My eyes are pretty lousy in the best of times. Like, I'm on bifocals, lights coming from different directions, books held a certain way just to be able to read the damn things right now. And that's in the best of times. Right now, my eyes are crossing. Got like no sleep, so I don't want to do a a well thought out email any kind of disservice by glossing over it. So we will cover that in another episode here. It's a really fun conversation from our friend Chris Yu, discussing annuals and how crazy the numbering and just the way annuals work and how we file them and all that kind of stuff. So fun conversation. I don't want to do it the disservice of just, pushing and glossing through it just to say we did it. So we will get that hopefully next time. Hopefully I get some sleep tonight and I wake up tomorrow a totally different human. So, with all that said, I'd still like to encourage and invite anybody who'd like to write in to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, Facebook, Instagram, not Instagram. I don't know why I said that. I haven't used Instagram in years at this point. Twitter, Facebook, those places, you know. But I'm going to stop babbling and hope that I can figure out how to edit this thing together. And I want to thank you all so much for, I suppose, dealing with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. We do not fall out of love, we die.